think he operated out of fear instead of embracing the clear will of the people.
A progressive group is targeting Senator Begich for his votes on gun control. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, April 19th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, cold weather farming in Bethel.
I mean, we can grow extremely high quality crops that people can actually live on, and we can grow it all over this region.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com.
And by
the Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage of state government since 1991. On the web at akbudgetreport.com.
A liberal group is running ads against Senator Mark Begich for his votes against expanded background checks for gun sales. Adam Green is the co-founder of the Progressive Change Campaign Committee. Green says his group and its 2,800 members in Alaska normally support Senator Begich and his work on entitlements like Social Security. But his gun votes this week drew the ire of liberals.
On the issue of guns and keeping guns out of the hands of criminals and the mentally insane, I think he operated out of fear instead of embracing the clear will of the people.
Green's Political Action Committee raises money for candidates and mobilizes the liberal base. He says running ads shaming Begich will not make him more vulnerable in his reelection bid. Begich may face Joe Miller in the 2014 Senate race, and if Miller does decide to run, voters can expect the same brand of fiery rhetoric he used to try to unseat Senator Murkowski in 2010. APRN's Peter Granitz reports.
Miller says he's not out to win a Senate seat. He's out to save the country. In a phone interview from Fairbanks, Miller rattled off a list of what he sees as infringements on liberty, including recent attempts to pass new gun control measures. Senator Mark Begich voted against every amendment supported by gun control advocates and the will of the majority of the U.S. population. Miller dismisses his votes as political opportunism.
Senator Begich is trying to reconstruct himself or reinvent himself as a conservative. It didn't work for Murkowski. It's not going to work for him. I mean, when you look at his past voting record in the last 4.5 years, that reflects who he is and what his political objectives are.
Miller is forming an exploratory committee that allows him to raise money without officially entering the race. He says he'll make a final decision sooner rather than later, but he would not give any indication what that means. In Anchorage, I'm Peter Granitz.
With many early mornings in the below zero temperatures this spring, you would think it would be impossible to grow crops at this time in western Alaska. But at Myers Farm in Bethel, they are doing just that. In fact, they have 10 rows of spinach that have just started to sprout. KYUK's Mark Earhart has more.
Tim Myers grows crops when basically no one else does in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. He does it in things called high tunnels.
Yes,
think a really big, long tent.
So these high tunnels are for season extension. And like I said, the ground was frozen so hard by September 8 last year that I couldn't get carrots out of the ground. And I was able to plant in here with a cedar at the end of October.
High tunnels are heated by only sunlight, so when the temperature is chilly outside, it's nice and warm for plants to grow on the inside.
Typically, gardening in Alaska, you're looking at the 1st of June to the end of August. June, July, August, 3 months. Now with this, from April, May, June, July, August, September, October, we're looking at 7 months. We're more than doubling the length of the season we can grow stuff with these high tunnels.
And so this morning was pretty chilly with wind chill, 8 below zero. How warm do you think it is in here?
It's about 48 degrees right now.
50 degree uptick. That's crazy.
Yeah, Yeah, just being inside.
Myers says by the middle of the afternoon, it can be in the 80s inside one of his high tunnels. We kneel down and pull up a long plastic covering showing a row of crops. And if you look closely, you can see little green sprouts of freshly planted spinach.
I can't believe it's all. Look at that.
It's amazing. They're just popping up.
Yeah. I need some water. I got to water it, but I don't have any water right yet. It's too darn cold yesterday trying to get water anywhere.
Meyer says once he packs in water from a local slough, his rows of spinach, carrots, and soon-to-be-planted strawberries will start to flourish in here. Soon the crops will be picked and sold at prices sometimes far cheaper than local grocery stores. Meyer says with the prices of food only going up, growing food out here on the tundra only makes sense in the long run.
If we're going to survive out here and we are able to grow this stuff, I see no reason we shouldn't be doing this. I mean, we can grow extremely high quality crops that people can actually live on, and we can grow it all over this region. This is the last good spot on our planet where we're able to do agriculture, and there's never been any done here before.
In Bethel, I'm Mark Earhart.
A large seafood processing plant will be constructed this summer in Naknek, and it's expected to be processing herring and salmon by next year. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
A seafood processing company with plans to enter Bristol Bay by next year updated commercial fishermen about their plans during the recent Business of Fish workshop in Naknek. Late last year, Silver Bay Seafoods announced plans to build a large processing plant in Naknek with the hope of processing salmon and herring by 2014. The entrance of Silver Bay Seafoods into the Bristol Bay processing sector drew praise from commercial fisherman Robin Samuelson, who serves as the president of the board of directors for the Bristol Bay Economic Development Corporation. BBEDC is heavily involved in the sockeye fishery in Bristol Bay through its 50% ownership stake in Ocean Beauty Seafoods. Samuelson gave the opening remarks at the recent Business of Fish workshop, and he admitted that Silver Bay Seafoods is a very aggressive company and will likely be vying for fishermen who currently fish for other companies.
I welcome Silver Bay to the Bay. I remember in the 60s and 70s the amount of processors we had and the amount we got today. And we definitely need more processors, and Silver Bay is going to be, I think, a very good addition to Bristol Bay and the fishermen of Bristol Bay.
The construction project manager for Silver Bay Seafoods was the keynote speaker at the recent Business of Fish workshop. Kevin Berry is in Naknek overseeing the initial construction activities at the site of the plant, which will lie along the Naknek River.
Here in Naknek, Silver Bay Seafoods is constructing a new modern freezing facility that will rapidly and efficiently freeze high volumes of product with the ability to expand into more value-added products in the future. It will be primarily an H&G operation.
The initial dirt work on the new plant is already underway, and once completed, it will be around 54,000 square feet in size. Barry confirms the company anticipates having a drift fleet of 100 to 150 vessels, all with the ability to chill their fish at the point of harvest through the use of refrigerated seawater systems.
That's certainly our preference. We're focused on the drift gillnet fishermen. We're looking at some prospective options with, the set net, but right now it's primarily focused on the drift gillnet.
One of the most common complaints by commercial fishermen in Bristol Bay is the lack of tenders, thanks to the retirement of vessels through the crab rationalization process. Barry asserted that Silver Bay will be bringing its own tenders to the bay from Prince William Sound and Southeast Alaska.
That's one of the things that's really been attractive for our fishermen, certainly in Southeast and in Prince William Sound, is a very, very strong tender fleet. We put a lot of effort into making those tenders very efficient.
Silver Bay Seafoods noted they plan to have a fishing fleet capable of harvesting 18% of the annual drift net harvest in Bristol Bay, and they hope to be able to buy 30% of the annual Togiak Sacro herring harvest. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the U.S. ski team works to convince Anchorage kids to try out ski jumping.
Most of our kids already cross-country ski. That's why they think Anchorage is the place where future Olympians will come from.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC.
and by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The state Fish and Game Department yesterday slapped restrictions on sports fishing for king salmon on many rivers that pour into Cook Inlet. Their press releases say the fisheries will be, quote, conservatively managed this year. Affected are all the rivers in the Susitna River Basin and some on the Kenai Peninsula. In the Mat-Su Valley, there will be a total 2-fish limit for the Susitna and Little Sioux drainage. A number of days will be catch and release only, although some retention will still be allowed on the Deshka, Talkeetna, Upper Susitna, and Chulitna. Also affected by the order as of May 1st are Kenai Peninsula rivers, though not the Kenai itself, including the Anchor, Nanilchik, Kasilof, and Deep Creek. They are aimed at the early Chinook run. The upper inlet restrictions start on the 15th of May and are aimed at spreading effort over the entire season to avoid mid-season closures, such as were imposed last year, says the Fish and Game Department. The Southeast Alaska sea otter population has more than doubled over the past decade. That's according to an estimate from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which released a draft of its revised stock assessment this week. As KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein reports, the numbers have been out for a while, but the public now has a formal chance to comment on them.
The draft estimates a total of 25,712 otters in the region. The number is based on aerial surveys done by researchers in 2010 and 2011. That compares with 10,563 otters in 2003. The latest numbers won't come as a surprise to many who have been following this issue. Federal scientists had already presented results from their population studies in public presentations and news reports over the past couple of years. The revised stock assessment formalizes the numbers and provides a 90-day opportunity for public comment. According to U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service spokesperson Bruce Woods, the agency will consider and incorporate public input before the draft is finalized.
Any input on habitat, degradation or improvement of habitat, any additional information, be it traditional ecological knowledge or personal observation that might help us refine our numbers, any additional information on human-caused mortality or injury that we may not be taking into account.
The Russian fur trade wiped out the Southeast sea otter population by the early 20th century. The state of Alaska reintroduced about 400 of the animals to Southeast in the 1960s, and they've thrived. According to the draft assessment, the region's otter population appears to be growing at a rate of 12% to 14% per year.
But what we're seeing is an indication of a population that is recovering and that is continuing to move into habitat that it formerly occupied and has probably not finished the process of recolonizing habitat that it once occurred in.
The otter's rapid population growth and voracious appetite for shellfish has been a major concern for commercial crabbers, dive fishermen, and subsistence harvesters for years. They've seen once productive fishing grounds for Dungeness crab, sea cucumbers, and other species depleted after the otters move in. Petersburg Assembly member and commercial fisherman Kurt Wolhuter chairs a local committee that's drafted a resolution on the issue for the rest of the assembly to consider. It takes the federal government to task for not developing a current plan to manage the otter population.
There is no management plan for the sea otters, and they're out of control at this point because they're eating, some of the crab fishermen out of house and home, and it is evident by fewer and fewer participants every year. And without the management tool for the sea otters, I'm afraid that at some point, that there will be no Dungeness fisheries, and that's the thing that really concerns everybody here.
The draft population assessment is available through a link on the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's website. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
The senior executive producer of a long-running and popular science documentary series on public television was in Fairbanks this week. Paula Apsell gave a 2-hour presentation on Wednesday night called The Art of Science Television. KUAC's Emily Schwing has more.
Every Wednesday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, science lovers tune their TVs to PBS for an hour-long show called Nova. It's a science documentary program that recently took viewers on a journey to explore the natural history of Australia. The show's also taken its audience on a quest to locate the minds of the Bible's famous King Solomon. Viewers have learned about medieval cathedral construction, and they've cracked the genetic code.
We saw the quantum world, the world of things that are teeny, 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 and it operates by different rules from our everyday world.
That's Paula Apsell. She's the senior executive producer of NOVA.
And by using computer graphics, we're able to bring the quantum world up to our size, and you can get a sense of how weird it really is.
She says she has a wealth of subject matter to choose from for every episode she produces.
I mean, NOVA is an anthology series, and that means we have the world of science, technology, engineering, medicine, natural history, the environment. We have a lot of different aspects of science to choose from. So that is a great benefit. And our programs can be very, very different week to week.
At any given time, Apsell is working on 20 different episodes, all in different stages of production. She says one of the challenges is finding a unifying quality among all of them.
We want them to have a level of quality and distinction that says this is a NOVA and not some other show.
Science can be intimidating to the general public. That's why Apsell says it's important to find a unique way to tell a science story.
The key thing is to tell the story and have it unfold like a detective story. So you ask a big question at the beginning, a mystery, and you follow the clues just as you would follow the clues in a forensic case.
Apsell admits her audience can be fickle.
The audience is not patient enough to wait for the end, so you have to keep revealing little tantalizing bits of information along the way. It's just differently. People want to know now, right at the beginning of the show, really what it's about. They want to know whether they should waste spend their time.
Public broadcasting competes with hundreds of cable television channels and fast-moving, superficial content on commercial networks. Even Apsell herself indulges in a little trashy TV once in a while.
You know, we all have our guilty pleasures. So I would be lying to you if I said I never watched Here Comes Honey Boo Boo or Hoarders. I mean, people who, you know, just hoard things, including dead animals. You're sort of sitting there watching it with your mouth hanging open. But after you watch three or four of the shows, you never have to watch it again. It sort of satisfies. But that's only true for me. These shows have an appropriate number of viewers to suit the advertisers.
But NOVA doesn't have advertisers. Funding for the program comes from the National Science Foundation and a wide-ranging list of underwriters, from the ExxonMobil Corporation to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. However, Apsell says that doesn't mean she hasn't had to find ways to innovate.
The pace of information has increased enormously. I mean, if you look at programs from 30 years ago, they're so slow you just think that you're going to fall asleep. So NOVA is not just television anymore. We're online. We have to stream our stuff. We have to make short-form videos of it. We do stories on radio. So I think one of the things that I've learned is, you know, over the past decade or so, it's just become extremely important to just extend to other platforms.
She says she'll continue to find ways to change how NOVA delivers rich and complex science stories to the public. The program has won every major broadcasting award, some more than once. NOVA's website is the most visited among those hosted by PBS. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com. Do you own a business or manage employees? Research shows that employees who feel supported at work with their parenting challenges are more loyal and productive. When you let employees know they can attend a teacher conference, stay at home with a sick child, or adjust their schedule to secure quality child care, you contribute to stronger families. That's Strengthening Families Alaska Style. This message is sponsored by Alaska Children's Trust, THRED, and Best Beginnings.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Aleknarechamut.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Amanda Compton. This week on AK, talent scouting. Dozens of kids in Anchorage got the chance to fly off the ski jumps at Hilltop Ski Area this winter.
The ski jumping program has expanded rapidly in the last 3 years, and the U.S. ski team is now eyeing Anchorage as a spot to develop young athletes for their successful Nordic Combined program, a sport that mixes ski jumping and cross-country skiing. A U.S. ski team coach was in the city last week to offer his guidance and encourage young kids to give the sport a try. APRN's Annie Feit has the story.
Nothing gets the attention of elementary school students quite like screwing up.
Oh, I missed him again!
And that's exactly what U.S. Nordic Combined coach Greg Poirier is doing. He's trying to catch Nordic Combined athlete Brian Fletcher in a mock jump. Fletcher crouches down on the gym floor at Bear Valley Elementary and then explodes up into the outstretched arms of his coach. On the third try, Poirier grabs him in exactly the right spot.
Yes!
Fletcher displays perfect jumping form, as if he's flying through the air.
Okay.
Now it's the kid's chance to give it a try.
Okay, ready? Jump!
The students are having a blast, and Coach Poirier clearly is too. When he looks at this group of students, he sees potential ski jumpers and cross-country skiers, future athletes who could help the U.S. continue its recent dominance in Nordic Combined. At the last Winter Olympics in Vancouver, the U.S. Nordic Combined team won 1 gold and 3 silver medals, more than any other country. Poirier says Anchorage could help further that success down the road.
You have thousands of kids out cross-country skiing on this fabulous trail system. I think the opportunity to grow the jump program where you have hundreds of kids jumping, that just bodes well for our athlete pool, and it's a great opportunity for us.
In 2010, only 3 kids were jumping at the Hilltop Complex in Anchorage. This year, there were 40. Ski jumping in Anchorage thrived in the 80s and 90s under the guidance of a demanding German pastry chef named Karl Eide. But after he died, the program fizzled. The resurgence in the sport is thanks largely to dedicated parents like Karen Compton. She's program director of the Jumping and Nordic Combined program for the Nordic Ski Association of Anchorage. She says the sport is a natural fit for the city.
Most of our kids already cross-country ski. And of those, some of them decided they would also ski jump. That's why they think Anchorage is the place where future Olympians will come from.
Compton is hoping to find funding to equip the jumps for summer training. That would be great news for Carter Brubaker. The 9-year-old started ski jumping last year and is a big fan of the sport.
You get a lot of air, and when you get that air, you can kind of you get this experience that you can't really do anywhere else.
Carter's mom, Jill, has 4 kids, and they are all enthusiastic ski jumpers. Although she says the sport has taken some getting used to, she says it's especially hard to watch her oldest son go off the biggest jump at Hilltop, the 64-meter.
To tell you the truth, I couldn't even watch it live for about 2 months last year. I could see it on video, and that was okay. It's pretty nerve-wracking to walk up to the top of that jump and see how high it is and watch them go off, but now I'm a little more used to it, and I see that it's a lot safer than it looks or safer than it sounds, and they're not afraid.
At the end of the gym class, Coach Poirier is pulling out all the stops to make his final pitch.
You get to skip school if you're a great ski jumper, but you still have to do your homework.
As the kids get ready to file out of the gym, Poirier tells them he hopes to see a future Nordic Combined Olympian come from Bear Valley Elementary. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week, we're heading to the community of Diomede in the middle of the Bering Strait between Alaska and Russia.
I'm Michelle Kulikhan. I'm originally from Gamble, but I live here in Diamond. When we last did a count, there was a little over 100 people. When I asked the principal, there was about 34 or 44 students enrolled, K through 12. So there's a lot of hiking, walking, climbing to go home. very nice during the summertime. You can climb to the top and climb around. If it's very nice weather, they go out and enjoy the weather outside. In the winter, you can get to go crabbing, no machine riding. There's no Hondas here, but I think there's one. People go picking here during the summer for greens. And then they also pick potatoes here, Eskimo potatoes, like regular potatoes, but they're so small. Oh, they cook them and then put them in seal oil, have them with Eskimo food. They're very sweet. The last part was the Christmas feast. Very good. People got together and cooked together. Everybody ate together. People get excited or happy when the chopper flies bring mail. And I believe there's 2 days of essential air service. Oh, we miss Eskimo dancing. They haven't had that in a while. Right now, they were looking for someone who would be a drum-making instructor, but nobody filled that position. I guess they need to remake new drums and hip-hop.
Michelle Coulihan is from Diomede. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Annie Feit, Alex Duer, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Amanda Compton.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Mark Earhart in Bethel, Mike Mason in Dillingham, Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, and Emily Schwing in Fairbanks. Our AK guest host this week was Amanda Compton. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Register now for the 2013 Business of Clean Energy in Alaska Conference, May 2nd and 3rd at the Dena Center in Anchorage. This fifth annual conference offers participants an unmatched opportunity to network with national industry experts and learn the latest on policies, programs, and projects in the clean energy industry. Online registration ends on April 26th. More information at www.bceaconference.com or 929-7770. This message sponsored by REAP, your voice for renewable energy. The School of Management at the University of Alaska Southeast has degrees online to prepare students for leadership positions across Alaska. Information at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by University of Alaska Southeast. Every day, people all over Alaska are discovering that public transportation can benefit their businesses and their communities. Public transportation in Alaska provides 7 million rides a year to work, medical appointments, shopping, school, and social opportunities. There's more information at alaskamobility.org. This message sponsored by the nonprofit organizations Alaska Mobility Coalition and the American Public Transportation Association.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.